Freedom Decrypted is sponsored by Think Penguin and Liberty Minded. Broadcasting live from our Freedom Decrypted studios in Keene, New Hampshire, this is Christopher Wade.
And I'm Johnson Rice.
So, Johnson, have you brought anything interesting today?
Yeah, I've got a couple things. a game developer has utilized the takedown process on YouTube to take down its own trailer for Fortnite. So the Fortnite developer,
I was reading about this, I think the other day, actually.
They screwed themselves over. Also, Creative Commons is apparently continuing to attempt to help courts understand what its non-commercial license means. So now the CC0, we mentioned a little bit last week,
actually. Yeah, did we? I don't remember.
We were talking about the public domain stuff.
Okay.
And they have this license, and the courts still don't necessarily know what to do with it.
So that's interesting. So I have a story about basically Facebook purging. And I think this is the big story over this week. Facebook purging 800 accounts involved in pushing political messages. And then I'd like to delve in. Now, we actually cover this on Free Talk Live, which is another show that Johnson and I both co-host. And it's it kind of ties into a story about how Silicon Valley has gone from a free speech, being pro free speech, above civility, and switching to a more European model of civility before free speech. So let's see here, and we're having computer problems.
I don't want to be offended.
You don't want to be offended?
I don't want to be offended ever. I need to be protected.
Well, that's what's coming up here on Freedom Decrypted today.
Don't say mean things.
And then we also have the Canadian music industry proposing a tax on the internet, a copyright tax on the internet, to be more precise. And we'll start with a article on Flatpak being a security nightmare from, oh my god, ubuntu.co.uk. So the title of the article is "New Website Claims Flatpak is Security Nightmare," and it is. Ubuntu is in agreement. They seem to be a very biased outlet. It seems like most places, you know, that we pull news from are biased. The question is it biased in the way that you that are more towards your political beliefs or somebody else's political beliefs? But nonetheless, and I don't really agree, even though I run a company that sells Linux and we ship a lot of Ubuntu systems, and GNU and stuff. I think we need to be more honest with ourselves about these types of issues. And unfortunately, Canonical and a lot of the whole industry as a whole has gone more in the way of a Microsoft model, which is very insecure, very hostile to freedom. And a lot of people don't necessarily understand the issues or why Microsoft is so insecure.
I think we need to get at least a few hundred people that send email to flatpak.org asking, does Flatpak decrease the security of my operating system? Because it's apparently not part of their frequently asked questions.
Interesting.
They don't have any mention of security whatsoever.
Part of the problem with Flatpak, I think, is not so much, it may not be so much a problem with Flatpak as it is with how things are being distributed and developed. So traditionally, we have a system of, and I think a lot of people don't really understand this, we have a system where, a traditional system where we have a repository or an app store, so to speak, and you can go to these central repositories for your distribution, and you can install software from these repositories that are basically, they've been vetted to some degree. And what I mean by that is, well, let's take Debian as an example. So Debian has developers, and those developers are vetted. It's not so much that each individual package is necessarily vetted so much as the developers, but that's, it's still an important part of security. And so in order to become a Debian developer, you have to get two other Debian developers to sign off and say, yeah, he's an honest guy, he writes good code, et cetera, et cetera. And so you end up having this minimal threshold for everything that's in the Debian's repository. Now, you know, it's not to say, if you start looking at Ubuntu's repository, which is based on Debian's, it's not to say that everything is, you know, perfect. It's, you know, if you start looking at outside the main repository, you know, things may not get updated, and that could be a security issue. But generally speaking, all of your main packages are there security updates for. And that's one of the big things if you want to have a secure environment. And so when you introduce something like Snaps, or you introduce Flatpaks into your system, and anybody can publish these, that's where the security issue comes about. So it's not really so much that package or programs are packaged in a way that include all the libraries and such. Now, that could be a security issue of itself, but that's not really the real underlying security issue here. Now, if those individual libraries that now you're duplicating on every system aren't being updated, obviously there could be security issues in there. And that's kind of where people are going with that. But then they kind of, you know, they kind of say, well, it's virtualized, and that will magically solve all the security issues. Guys, it won't. But that's kind of the argument. So let's start. Let me go into this. And
there's you mentioned the thing about virtualized, and I happened to be looking for any kind of mention of security in the Flatpak.
And they start talking about virtualization, right?
Yeah, they say, is Flatpak compatible with other desktop isolation frameworks? In general, unprivileged container systems can't stack because anything running inside the sandbox does not have the necessary privileges to set up a sandbox, nor does it have the ability to raise its privileges in any way. For instance, Firejail can never work inside Flatpak because it is setuid. That being said, using multiple sandboxing frameworks at once does not really make anything more secure, so there's little point in trying to nest things like that. It's certainly possible for Flatpak and Flatpak applications to coexist with applications that are packaged in other ways on the same host system.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to design a secure system or a better or more secure system, the last thing you want to be doing is, you know, this Flatpak snap type of design. It's for so many, there's multiple reasons, and people are saying, well, it's secure, it's not. A newly launched website is warning users about Flatpak, branding the tech a security nightmare. The flatkills.org webpage takes aim at a number of security claims routinely associated with the fledgling Flatpak app packaging and distribution formats. The three areas are flagged by the site, which is currently doing the rounds on social media, that its authors contends are not readily apparent to users. Many Flatpak, and this is actually an issue here too. So this is the other aspect of Snaps and Flatpak that are a problem. So
hey, what's the website?
It's flatkills.org.
flatkills.org.
In any event, people bring sites down temporarily to update them and things like that, so I wouldn't worry about it. Check it in a few minutes. You don't know, and this is another problem with Ubuntu, at least with Snaps, is you don't know what is in the repository that's legit and what is a Flatpak, it's Snap in that particular case. So you can actually go into the Ubuntu Software Center, and you can search for VLC as an example. And I don't know if this is currently the case, but it's possible they removed this, but it's not. It's also possible that it's still there. But if you search for a VLC, you'll find that there's a VLC that's in the repository. And then you'll find this other VLC. The VLC that's in the repository has basically a lot of, you know, it has thousands of, reviews for it, right? Or ratings.
The article got it wrong. It's actually flatkill.org.
Oh, okay.
No S.
And then, well, it shouldn't surprise me because they're very clearly biased. And then there is the Flatpak VLC. And the Flatpak VLC, we don't know who it is that published it. We don't know anything about it. And it's like it's just waiting for somebody to make the mistake and install the wrong package. And this is where we end up with a security nightmare situation that's Windows. On Windows, you never know when you download a package. You never know whether or not that package is genuine or secure or anything. You're just kind of, you know, you're blindly trusting. There's no system to vet it, right? And it's not even to say that, you know, the Debian system, the Debian model is perfect. It's simply better than what we have in the Windows world. And it's better than what we now have with Ubuntu and Fedora and all these other newer Snap and Flat Pack distribution mechanisms. And again, it's actually, I think, more of a change in the repository or a change in the way Ubuntu Software Center is set up. So it may be okay to have the Flatpak to some degree or Snaps to some degree if you are going to distinguish between the two. But at the same time, it actually is easier to go to a website and vet something than it is to go to a repository, which basically lets anybody upload anything.
So I'm taking you didn't actually look at, you haven't seen flatkill.org.
I don't know if I actually checked out flatkill.org.
I think it might make sense to read it because I think it'll be interesting and have you comment on some of the things that are said here because I think it's probably
Let's go through the article first. Sure. The article probably already picks up on it, but it just in a more biased way. So let's just do the article real quick. Yeah. And then it's not a long article. It's not like we have to cover the whole thing either necessarily. We frequently don't cover the whole article. I mean, technically that would be copyright probably violation if we did. Three areas are flagged by this site, which is currently doing the rounds on social media. That its authors contends are not readily apparent to users. Many Flatpak apps have file system write permission. Most Flatpak apps do not run in a sandbox. See, that's even more interesting because the whole argument for like Snaps and Flatpak and stuff is that it's basically virtualized so they can't touch outside the system, which isn't totally true. But nonetheless, they use it to make that argument. Slow, no critical security updates to apps and runtimes. And this is a very good point, and I like to point out. So yeah, it's easier to package Flatpak and Snaps because you don't have to build the software for each individual distribution. I believe anyway that's how it's working. But as a result, it has to build all the libraries that are needed for that piece of software as well. And in a normal situation, those individual libraries get security updates upstream. But in the case of, you know, a Flatpak or a Snaps package, you don't end up having that. The developer who releases that software has to basically, I guess, push out the updates, so to speak. And so we end up having this security nightmare situation. And it's the same way software is distributed on Windows. It's the developer, generally speaking, is going to have all the libraries ship with the product. And it's not going to be maintained anywhere near as well from a security standpoint. Examples of the alleged shortcomings are provided by the author of the site, who goes on to conclude that the way we package and distribute desktop applications on Linux surely needs to be rethinked. Sadly, Flatpak is introducing more problems than it is solving. Absolutely. Flatkills, and again, he got it wrong, flatkill.org is asking users who think Flatpak is a safe and secure way to get apps on Linux to think again. But should they? Flatpak security, should you be worried? I am. I've seen it I've seen it live. I've seen malicious software in the Ubuntu Software Center. Blunt though, the viral website is clear that the author behind it cares about the Linux desktop user expectations and application security. After all, no one goes to the effort of launching an entire website solely for a wheeze. That said, the concerns listed on flatkill.org are not, to my mind, problems with Flatpak itself, but with the Linux app distribution in general. Well, okay, so, you know, I sort of would agree with that, but that wasn't an issue before Flatpak and Snap.
Right.
So I think this is kind of, it's still an issue created by Snap and Flatpak, or at least a change to the Ubuntu Software Center and similar systems, where if you're including Flatpak and Snaps in a system that doesn't have any vetting of the developers, you're going to end up with malware in that system. And that's why we have problems with Android and we end up Android is probably the closest example of a system where we have problems with because of that lack of vetting anything whatsoever, outside of the, you know, core software anyway. Is this me or is this just really bad writing?
It's bad writing. Okay. For one, all of security features that Flatpak touts in its documentation. I feel like maybe it's being written by somebody who's
first English. Hey, within marketing materials are available. The problem is not that these controls don't exist. They do, but most app developers distributing Flatpak apps choose not to make use of them. Okay, yeah. The problem is not that sandboxing doesn't exist. It does. Well, hold on. Didn't we just say so they're saying that you can use sandboxing, but you don't have to. Okay, fair enough. Exist, but the app devs choose not to use it. Apps like GIMP, VS Code, and Lollipop ship with broad permission sets, which users are made aware of when installing using the Flatpak CLI, but not in a graphic user interface install by default. You know, I probably would have less of an objection to Flatpak if you were getting the Flatpaks, the packages from GIMP.org, right? That kind of makes sense. But if you're getting it from the Ubuntu Software Center or something equivalent to that, that's where the problem comes in, because there's no way to vet it. And even, and getting it from GIMP.org, you can be pretty confident, like getting it from GIMP.org is probably going to be okay, right? Traditionally, you could be confident that getting it from the Ubuntu Software Center was going to be okay, because you know who was packaging it. You knew somebody who was vetted by Debian or Ubuntu, did the packaging. But that's not the case anymore. This isn't a flaw in anything other than motivation. For these apps to do what they do, many packagers idly request both read-write access to the home folder instead of using other mechanisms available. Again, the situation is not unique to Flatpak. Well, it is unique to Flatpak and Snaps. It's not unique necessarily to doing packages. Although, in some respects, it is still, because we don't actually have... what am I thinking of? I'm not thinking of SE Linux so much, but SE Linux is also another example. You probably don't know what I'm talking about either. AppArmor. So AppArmor is basically a security model where you determine what the application needs and then restrict that application from having access to other things that it doesn't need. And so it is something that has to be done at an application level. And so, in a sense, yeah, not all applications are going to have that security model added to it. But all of your primary applications that, would probably be more of a concern, things like Firefox, they're going to have new browsers and things like that. They're going to have they're going to have these security things implemented. But if you go and download, say, a Snap or a Flatpak package for Firefox, it's not going to have that. Again, the situation is not unique to Flatpak or the FlatHub app store. Many popular Snap apps don't make use of strict confinement either. Again, yeah, it's because you're now giving... There's some good that comes out of having somebody else package for your distribution than having the upstream developer package for your distribution. And it's not to say that, developers upstream should not be packaging for the distribution, but they shouldn't be showing up in the Ubuntu Software Center or similar types of repositories, or when you're searching them at least. But settings related to sandboxing and permissions or lack thereof is decided by the application packager, not the creator of the format. Perhaps Flatpak could throw up a GUI permission, graphical user interface permission dialog to ask for file system write permission on the first run. See, now this would be not a bad idea, especially if it asks for permission, but you also had the option of giving it like a fake permission, so it doesn't actually gain access to your home folder, like even if it says it requires it. And that's one of the problems we have with Android right now. You basically have two choices. You can accept it or you can deny it. You can't say other, and then other being give it a fake environment, right? And that's something that could be done to improve security. So, or list again via a graphic user interface, which permissions an app requires before the users install it, like Android used to. But we're talking about a technology that only recently hit version 1.0. It's not going to reach perfection overnight. Well, you know what's interesting? We've actually had stuff like Flatpak and Snaps before. This is not new. It's just maybe the first time that we've had a maybe a more upstream approach to it, in the sense that, you know, Ubuntu and other distributions are getting on board with this distribution, or a more distribution agnostic approach to packaging. For what it's worth, Flatpak developers are working on an improved app permissions model with portals. These allow granular control of permissions. Portals are high-level sessions bus APIs that provide selective access to resources to sandbox applications. The implicit expectation of portals is that the user will always be involved in granting or rejecting a portal request. Thus, most portal APIs will lead to user integration in the form of dialogues. Among the planned portals is a file chooser. This will provide sandbox apps indirect access to files, but with the user staying in control of which files can or cannot be opened. Apps get the permission they need to run efficiently, but without the drawback of having permissions to everything. I'm a big fan of Snap's apps permissions model, which lets you check in on and revoke app permissions at any time. For both strict snaps, which can't write to your home folder, and classic snaps, which can, from the Ubuntu software store, I'm thinking is what they're trying to say. Flatpak had a similar Flatpak has similar controls too, albeit from the command line interface. That said, and again, like Snap apps running in classic mode, the notion of sandboxing isn't quite as watertight as the marketing merits make out. Yeah, that's a really good statement. But if idea of Flatpak's enjoying unbridled access to your home folder may sound scary, but if you install apps from PPAs or OBS or other third-party repos, you're exposed to the exact same risks, only worse. Those apps will have root. Whoa. Hold on a moment. I'm sorry, but I understand the potential security risks of PPAs, and randomly installing PPAs is probably not a good idea. But selectively installing PPAs, I don't think is anywhere near as dangerous when you have when you know where the source is. If you're doing random, you know, installing random PPAs that you find on the internet, that's a risk. But if you're installing a PPA from GIMP or Tor or some other, you know, project, you're getting it from the source. You're getting it from the developers themselves. If you don't trust the developers themselves, who can you trust? So I think this is very misleading. Whereas in the case of Flatpaks and snaps, it basically anybody can package it, a snap or a Flatpak, and then upload it to the Ubuntu Software Center, so to speak. I don't even know if I want to read any more of this. I think people get the idea.
Let's go through this thing and have you address, you know, some of the things that I said here. So Flat Hat's Red Pack has been getting a lot of attention lately, the self-proclaimed way of distributing desktop applications on Linux. It's secure, they say. This is again from flatkill.org. The sandbox is a lie. Almost all popular applications on FlatHub come with file system equals host, file system equals home, or device equals all permissions. That is, write permissions to the user home directory and more. This effectively means that all it takes to escape the sandbox is to, it says echo, download, and execute evil, dot bash rc, that's it. This includes GIMP, VS Code, PyCharm, Octave, Inkscape, Steam, Audacity, VLC, ... To make matters worse, the users are misled to believe that the apps run sandboxed. For all these apps, Flatpak shows a reassuring sandbox icon when installing the app. Things do not get much better when installing in the command line. You need to know Flatpak internals to understand the warnings.
Yeah, I'd agree with this guy's assessment of Flatpak.
This one's a huge one too. You're not getting security updates. Official application. I mean, and this, you know, forget about just getting it from the developer and whatnot. I mean, that's a huge thing if it's not installed, you know, the normal way, when updates are run, you're not getting the security updates. We should back up a moment
because there are lots of apps in Ubuntu, for example, that don't get security updates, but all of the ones that are maintained by Canonical are supposed to have security updates, mm-hmm. Where they're applicable. And so you do have to keep things in perspective. It's not a perfect system. It's never been a perfect system, but this,
I'm running Ubuntu and I'm getting app updates all the time, you know?
Oh yeah. Pretty much all of your core applications that are going to be attacked or likely to have be attacked.
Right.
You know, they're going to get the security updates, right? Yeah. LibreOffice, anything that comes installed, Firefox, right. Those all are going to get security updates from Canonical.
Yeah. So it says, often applications and runtimes are vulnerable to known easily exploitable code execution vulnerabilities. Some of these vulnerabilities have been known and fixed in distributions, but not in Flatpak for half a year. Yes, it's possible your Linux box has not been compromised if you use Flatpak. We are literally talking about several months old public exploits. It's possible your Linux box has been compromised if you use Flatpak, because they're talking about several month old public exploits. Have you ever opened an image in Flatpak GIMP? The critical vulnerability, Shell in the Ghost, was fixed in Flatpak about 1 month after Linux distributions. Let's go through DSA and look for something trivial to exploit. It's got a CVE number here, reported and fixed more than 4 months ago. Flatpak and VS Code, Android Studio, and Sublime Text still used the unpatched Git version 2.9.3. Note that Flatpak PyCharm comes with Git 2.19.0 with this issue fixed, but still vulnerable to CVE. We can demonstrate this using Sublime Git Savvy plugin with recursive clone plugin. It's just talking about how he can demonstrate this and how out of date these pieces of software are.
So it's interesting. So GIMP is probably not as likely to be an issue relative to something like Firefox. And I'm looking here to see if in Ubuntu there is actually what is it maintained and what is not maintained by Ubuntu, because obviously Ubuntu is one of the main distributions, mm-hmm. And most distributions are based on Ubuntu that are popular. So what I'm looking at is GIMP is actually not maintained by Canonical, and I don't know if there's anybody's actually pushing out security updates. They seem to be, given what the story is saying. I don't know if that's actually a fact or not, I guess it is, because it does sound like it must be. But the point is that, like, you wouldn't necessarily assume that you're going to be getting security updates for something like GIMP that's in the universe repository. That's not something that's officially maintained by Canonical, but something like Firefox is officially maintained by Canonical. And that would definitely be more of an issue than installing something,
Wait,
else.
So, even if it's not maintained by Canonical, if they release an update, isn't it going to be, if it's in the repository, isn't that update going to be pushed to the repository? I mean, the developers themselves are going to push that No.
So the way it works is, if it's in the main repository, mm-hmm. Then Canonical is going to provide security updates for those packages, okay? If it's not in the main repository, then it's not going to be maintained by Canonical.
But it still could be maintained by those developers, right?
It could still be maintained
by... It probably is, in most cases.
It could still be. And it might be the case that... And I don't know. I don't know this with certainty, but they may be also importing security updates
from
Debian upstream.
The point that I'm making is if the developers are doing the maintenance, maybe even if Canonical is not doing the maintenance and the developers are doing the maintenance and are then providing that to the repository, right? Mm-hmm. Then it's the method of delivery, because those updates, you will still get them, and you will get them in a timely fashion. If you're using a Flatpak and you have to go and fetch and download an application, then you're not going to get those, you're not going to get those updates in a timely fashion. It's just about method of delivery, not necessarily about the developers and whatnot. It's just delivery method.
It may be. Look, there is a certainly a lot that's that is left to be desired. I think if you want to talk about security, probably the Debian distribution is the most, and I know people are going to cringe when I say this, is the most secure in terms of package updates. But I'm not saying Debian is designed to be secure in the same sense that maybe something like OpenSUSE, or for example, might be. OpenSUSE has definitely done a lot of work to improve security, and Ubuntu and Debian probably have too, but they tend to be a little bit further behind. But what they do have is they have security updates, and that's something that you may be lacking in Ubuntu when it comes to non-canonical maintained packages.
There's a couple more issues here that they bring up. Local root exploit? Minor issue. Up until 0.8.7, all it took to get root on the host was to install a Flatpak package that contains an SUID binary. Flatpaks are installed to /var/lib/flatpak on your host system. Again, could this be any easier? A high severity CVE, it says CVSS score 7.2, has indeed been assigned to this vulnerability. Flatpak developers consider this a minor security issue. And then he goes on and he says, the future of application...
It is to some degree a minor issue if you trust the source. But if you don't trust the source, which you shouldn't, if you're using something like Ubuntu Software Center and it's a Flatpak, you shouldn't trust the source because you have no idea where it's coming from. Anybody can upload snap packages to the source. And I know they're talking about Flatpak here, but we have equivalent. I mean, Flatpak is basically the Fedora Red Hat equivalent to, you know, snaps. Okay, so anyway, I'm sorry, keep, go ahead and continue.
So it's the future of application distribution, ? Let's hope not. Sadly, it's obvious Red Hat developers working on Flatpak do not care about security, yet the self-proclaimed goal is to replace desktop application distribution, a cornerstone of Linux security. And it's not about these security problems. Running KDE apps in fake pack? Forget about desktop integration. Not even font size. Need to input Chinese characters, Japanese, Korean characters? Forget about that too. FCITX has been broken since Flatpak 1.0 and never fixed since. The way we package and distribute desktop applications on Linux surely needs to be rethinked. Sadly, Flatpak is introducing more problems than it is solving.
Yeah, it's very true. So I got a story here from the Canadian Music Group, and they're proposing a copyright tax on internet use. I'm going to try not to spend too much time on this because we have, unfortunately, about an hour for the show. In Canada, there have been ongoing discussions and proposals about new levies and fees to compensate creators for missed revenue. There have been calls to levy a tax on mobile devices such as iPhones, for example. This week, the Screen Composers Guild of Canada took things up a notch, calling for a copyright levy on all broadband data use above 15 gigabytes per month. I mean, can you imagine being limited to 15 gigabytes? That's like maybe you use on your phone, right? That's absolutely insane that they think that anybody who's using more than 15 gigabytes a month is basically streaming industry's content. Basically, there is so much on the internet that is not the video. This show is an example,
right?
Free Talk Live.
I can use 2 gigs in about 15 minutes.
Idea that that you have to be,
if you're a content producer, you'd be screwed.
Yeah,
you need to like download a big video you produced and then upload it somewhere. I mean,
this is basically a cash grab by a particular group that didn't the film guild, you know, basically the composer, the people who write the plots, I guess you could say, to the entertainment that you get. And it's and the thing is, the issue is they're not doing a good job negotiating with Netflix and other online distribution platforms. So they're getting a raw deal, but that shouldn't be that. Just because you're a bad negotiator does not mean that the government should step in and basically steal from others in order to fund your creative endeavors or your business. Okay. I mean, this is like bailing out the banks. We probably shouldn't have bailed out the banks. We shouldn't. There's all this stuff that we shouldn't be doing. We shouldn't be guaranteeing income to what are actually profitable businesses already. And these people are just, they're demanding more money. And I understand that they're kind of in a tough position. But at the same time, it's like, you're not the only business with your business doesn't even have competition. That's actually the crazy thing. Their business doesn't even have competition and they're unable to negotiate. Right. So the whole idea that, you know, we should be going in and taxing somebody who may not even be utilizing their entertainment content or accessing that type of content is just ridiculous. And the most hilarious thing is they're not even talking about piracy. They're talking about things like Netflix. So basically, you as a user are paying Netflix, and because this group isn't able to negotiate a good deal with Netflix, they want to tax you. And everybody, mm-hmm. even if you're not using their services and products. When CD copying was all the rage in the late 1990s, many countries started to levy a tax, which is also absolutely ridiculous, on blank media. I have never burned a CD, an audio CD, that will probably have contributed to some who have gotten paid by any of these groups. I've burned audio CDs, like music CDs, before with content, but it was from independent artists, very, very small independent artists that would never have received any, you know, royalties or funds. And in fact, they were giving away their music. So why should I? But I've bought thousands and thousands of CDs over the years. Why should I have to pay a tax for every one of those CDs when I've never downloaded any major entertainment content from any of the major entertainment producers that will end up getting the money from this tax, assuming I had lived in Canada anyway. I think this is just ridiculous. This meant that consumers had to pay an extra fee on every recordable disc because these can be used to duplicate copyrighted content. In some countries, this model has expanded to other media such as hard disks, MP3 players, and phones. In Canada, however, this hasn't happened despite several attempts in the past. There is no private copying levy on smartphones, tablets, or hard disks. And you know what makes this all the worse is at the same time that they have these taxes, you're already paying for the music basically that you download off pirate sites, but assuming you download off pirate sites, I'm trying to say, but they will still go after you in places like Canada, even though you've already paid the tax that funds their operations. So you're still a pirate, so to speak, even though you're in Canada and you've paid your taxes on the CD media that you're burning and then going out and downloading it from some unauthorized source.
Be nice if we could change government so that, you know, instead of having taxes that everybody has to pay, instead we have it so that anytime a politician wants to propose a law, they have to raise $1 million just to make the proposal. And that has to be done through voluntary means. That'd be a good way of, you know, that way there'd be a lot less laws.
Yeah.
And, you know, there'd be a lot less interference in people's lives. And, you know, they'd still be able to offer infrastructure by raising money voluntarily.
Yeah. Let's see here. Decentralized property. Okay. Yeah. So it's just I didn't want to go on too much with this article, particularly because we are short on time, and I did have a bunch of stories I wanted to cover. I'm gonna go, and I don't want to go too much into the whole Facebook story, but I did want to just briefly cover on it, because I did already talk about it for like 2 hours on Friday here. if you want to hear more about this story, go to freetalklive.com and click on archive, and then you can actually listen to 2 hours of me and Ian and Daryl talking about this story. So basically, this is the biggest news this week. Facebook has purged over 800 accounts and pages pushing political messages, basically that they don't like.
So the war on thought has begun.
Yeah, this story comes from LA Times. There's a lot of stories all over the news about this, though. And I don't know if this is just the tech news or what, but it's certainly been in the news this week. Facebook said Thursday that it has purged more than 800 U.S. publishers and accounts for flooding users with politically oriented content that violated the company's spam policies, a move that could reignite accusations of political censorship. Well, yeah. I want to actually talk a little bit about who they have terminated, because it's quite disturbing. They've basically targeted conservative groups, libertarian groups, groups that don't have a socialist agenda. I guess is probably the way to say it. They don't have the same agenda as Facebook. The accounts and pages with names like Reasonable People Unite and Reverb, I don't know any of these. These are probably minor things. But I'm gonna pull over. I did print off and I don't have it on my computer in front of me here. I just want to go over this list, and it's something that's very close to home. And these are people that Johnson and I, mm-hmm. some of them anyway, we know are in our community here up here in Keene, New Hampshire. So the Free Thought Project, you've heard of that, Johnson, right?
I have.
All right. Cop Block, you've heard of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
We actually know the people who founded the original Cop Block. They were living here in New Hampshire, Keene, actually, I believe, Keene, New Hampshire at the time, right?
Yes, they were.
Yeah, that's what I thought. They weren't here while I've lived up here in Keene, New Hampshire, but I believe Johnson was, you were here
for
when
a brief,
it was founded.
Yeah, for when I first moved
yeah.
up.
The Liberty Principle, no consent from the governed, policing the police. I mean, these are actually, so some of these are actually police accountability. So CopLock is a police accountability group, basically, that goes around and films police basically behaving inappropriately, oftentimes people get arrested for filming the police, which is constitutionally protected, but nonetheless, policing the police, legalizing cannabis, voluntarist veterans, end the war on drugs, hemp. So I mean, basically, yeah, these are like,
it's interesting. I have a list here of from an article that has a list of them. And it says, just a note on it, it says, you'll notice the majority of these pages refer to nature, health, natural medicine, organic food and living, almost without exception. And the remaining of the pages feature words such as freedom, Tesla, conscious, awakening, aware, alternative, and medication. It's just, it's interesting that, all these pages do seem to follow a very...
And it's interesting because the arguments that they're using against these sites or pages, I guess, mm-hmm. Are basically, they're not being used against the major the major news outlets. So they're selectively, even though the major news outlets are doing a lot of the same things. So they're basically utilizing their spam policies selectively to target groups that they don't like. And it's interesting. So one of the things that I just wanted to read from one of the people who has some pages that have been censored. So Facebook just purged hundreds of independent news pages. Let's see. Actually,
oh, wow. Facebook refused to disclose the full list.
Ah, that's interesting. So I tried to post a link. So this is posted by one person who actually had pages. It was pages that impacted him. I tried to post a link that new news about the big company that owns YouTube and how they are censoring people. I'm sorry, owns YouTube. So they're talking about Google here. But it's all relates to Facebook too. Still, Facebook said they detected unusual activity on my account, locked me out of my account, and maybe upload a photo and wait an hour to prove it's me. Basically, this is an article. What he's talking about is an article on the censorship that's been going on in the Silicon Valley companies, where they're moving to a European style. Putting free speech second to civility, and so it's really terrible. Then I got back in, I scheduled the post for tonight, and it vanished. So I mean, this is outright censorship here, and not of pages, but of an account, I guess, or a linking to an article in regards to this issue on Facebook. Then I tried again now and got this. You have been temporarily blocked from performing this action. If you think this doesn't go against community standards, let us know. So I guess basically linking to articles, posting articles that are banned because Facebook doesn't like the articles is acceptable now. And now Facebook is a private entity, so I don't necessarily want to say they shouldn't be able to allow to do this by law, but certainly this is a good reason why you guys shouldn't be using Facebook. I've never used Facebook. I know a lot of people who have gotten off Facebook since then, and they're not moving to WhatsApp, guys. WhatsApp is owned by Facebook.
It looks like, I mean, there are apparently some liberal pages that got trashed. So Progressive Voices, We Miss Obama, Liberals Unite Today, Reasonable People Unite.
But, you know, they may still have, despite the fact that they may have been along the same political philosophy, they may not have liked the content that that was coming out. So it still doesn't necessarily mean that they're not being...
Americans against Donald Trump.
Yeah, well, what I noticed was a lot of conservative and libertarian groups that were being targeted, seemingly.
You're in that community.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
I would love to.
I would notice that.
Facebook refuses to provide the whole list, so it makes it kind of difficult to go ahead and figure out, you know, is there a bias slant by looking at all the sites that are deleted and seeing is there, you know, any kind of bias that's very clear from
even if we're going to say it's not biased, which I don't believe Facebook for one minute isn't, but let's say it's not biased, is this an appropriate course of action to take? And I would disagree. I don't think it is. One of the things we talked about actually on Free Talk Live was how people are moving.
I just stumbled upon a page that was deleted named Chelsea Clinton is Donkey from Shrek.
One of the things that people should be looking at are moving away from centralized platforms like Facebook and moving towards platforms isn't even the right word at this point, software that is decentralized. So for example, we have Mastodon is a good example. Free Talk Live has a Mastodon feed now. Anyway, so now that's a replacement for something like Twitter as opposed to Facebook. But there are other options out there. And I'm going to be the first to admit I haven't looked too much into them. I don't use Facebook myself, but that doesn't mean I'm necessarily jumping on the social bandwagon period. So, but certainly it's something that if I wanted to jump on the social bandwagon, I would be looking at because it helps to hinder censorship. Mastodon is, there's not a central site. You can set up your own instance, and there are, I think we decided there were thousands of instances. I think there were like 5,800 instances of Mastodon instances, and you can sign up basically to anyone that will allow you to sign up to them anyway. And so, for example, there's a Liberdon Mastodon instance, and so some of the people we know signed up with that. I personally have our own instance that we set up, and that hosts a handful of people, and it's not open to the public like the Liberdon instance is, at least to any libertarians. But there are also other Mastodon instances that are open to socialists, they're open to, and it's interesting because Mastodon actually enables censorship, but it doesn't do it in a way that is going to be a significant issue. If they block you from Facebook, there's nothing you can do about it. If a Liberdon instance blocks you from accessing their instance, you can just go and sign up for another instance somewhere else on some other instance, or set up your own if you know you have some really, really, you know, out there views, like you're a KKK member or I don't know, something. Now that doesn't necessarily mean that instance is going to show up on another instance if the socialists want to block that instance on that socialist Liberdon server. That's fine, they can do that. You can still probably individually communicate with others on that instance, but anyway, basically it allows for groups that don't necessarily have views that everybody likes to, you know, prosper, just as groups that are in the majority can prosper. Freedom of speech is not for people who are in the majority. Freedom of speech is for people who are in the minority. And it's a very dangerous thing, because one day you might be in the majority, but another day you might be in the minority. And you just look at World War II and Hitler and everything else, you know. What happens when Hitler, or in many cases, if you're a socialist, Trump, you know, what happens then? You want to have protections. You want to have an outlet. And so decentralization is the way to do that, regardless of what side you're on. And it would be ignorant to think that your particular beliefs or government or whatever is always going to be on top. So did you have it? So which stories did you want? Did you want to do some stories?
Sure. So
I do have some other ones. Microsoft tackles horrifying big. Actually, let me just do this real quick. As it sort of applies into the whole Facebook thing. So it's not just Facebook and Google and so forth that are doing the censoring. If we take a look at Microsoft here, I have a story from BBC.com about Microsoft tackles horrifying Bing search results. I'm going to be really quick here. Let's see here. Microsoft has taken action to change its Bing search engine after it was found to give horrifying results for search terms. Journalist Chris Hoffman discovered Bing suggested racist topics when he looked up words such as Jews, Muslims, and black people. You know, this is the thing.
AI always tends to become racist too when it's allowed to search the internet.
It does. And the reason, part of the reason for this is because the reality is people are racist, people are, you know, bigoted, whatever. Okay. It's basically giving you the contents that you're searching for, or the type of content that you're searching for. Okay. Jews apparently don't go in and search for Jews. Right. I mean, so it's not going to give you content that is not race. I mean, this is just how things are. Right. I don't want a search engine that's going to give me content that is other than what I'm searching for. So the whole idea, you know, and it's not to say I go online and search for racist content. I don't. But if I was, I would want it to give me racist content. And if you go and you start, you know, censoring like this, then all of a sudden you have a censored, you know, you're gonna start believing things that aren't necessarily true, because your worldview is going to shrink, and that's not a good thing. There's a reason people, well-educated people, tend to travel, like to travel, encourage their kids to travel, so that they have a broader worldview. And doing this censorship thing is very harmful to everybody's well-being. So yeah, debunked. Deeper look. So anyway, but this kind of just ties into this same, the whole theme, and I don't want to actually continue with this article. I think it's just bringing up that Microsoft is also censoring, you know, users now. Basically,
it's just
is basically the gist of it, and it's not just
Zeitgeist.
Yeah, it's not just Microsoft and Facebook and Google. There, I mean, the whole tech sphere is going in that direction. So let's go
big,
on to your
Big Brother is watching you, and Newspeak is happening. 1984 is becoming a reality, for sure. Speaking of which, another developer has DMCA'd its own video game trailer. We have plenty of stories of revolving around content owners and publishers issuing DMCAs over trailers and advertisements. These stories are always head-scratching in one way or another, typically centering around the question of why anyone would ever want to take down free advertising, even imperfect free advertising. We've also seen plenty of examples of content owners accidentally sending DMCA notices over their own content, all of which help to highlight both the flaws in the DMCA process and just how difficult it is for even content owners themselves to know just what is infringing and what isn't. But when these two worlds collide, it becomes something special. We're not yet 100% certain, but it looks like Epic Games DMCA'd its own trailer for the upcoming Fortnite Season 6. Fortnite Season 6 trailer was briefly taken down earlier this week after receiving a strike from YouTube for copyright infringement. That alone would be strange enough, since trailers and promotional videos typically secure the rights to any third-party media ahead of time, but the real kicker here is who issued the claim. According to a screen grab posted by Reddit, it was none other than Fortnite's own developer, Epic Games. The internet then spent the next day or so poking fun at Epic in the form of memes and in-game references, but this isn't really much of a laughing matter. And Whatever actually happened here, it serves to show the flaws in the DMCA process relating to YouTube videos. The most likely explanation is that Epic has an automated system to flag in DMCA videos that contain content from Fortnite. The problem here is that this was a trailer for an upcoming release, meaning that it would be odd for the algorithm to already be set to pick up on that content. Perhaps it's simply recognizing the general game or the characters and flagging it. But we don't know for sure, and given the vast amounts of Let's Plays and other content on YouTube featuring Fortnite, it's hard to square just why this trailer would have been flagged when other videos are not. Regardless, the end result would be that Epic Games DMCAing its own advertisement, the very last thing it would want to do, if that doesn't show the flaw in how the DMCA process is handled on all sides right now, it's hard to imagine what would.
DMCA is a failed piece of legislation that should never have existed in the first place. And I think what should have happened is they should have just gotten rid of copyright outright.
Yeah.
I think it's a mistake. It takes away. It says you have some sort of ownership over what other people think and can see and read and say. And it's a mistake. The whole thing is just a mistake.
I'm going to go ahead and take that as a segue, as a perfect segue into getting rid of copyright.
Okay.
Creative Commons, their CC0 non-commercial license for people who don't want to copyright their stuff, but still want it protected from people who would, slap copyright on it and use it for themselves. Creative Commons continues to try and help courts to understand what its non-commercial license means. Over the years, we've expressed some concerns, and these stories both came from Tech Dirt, about the non-commercial license option from Creative Commons. Even as we're incredibly supportive of Creative Commons, the non-commercial license often seemed to raise more questions than answers, to the point that some have argued that it actually harmed CC's brand and resulted in significant confusion for how Creative Commons licenses work. There have even been suggestions that CC should drop the non-commercial license option altogether. To its immense credit, the people at Creative Commons have appeared to take these concerns quite seriously over the past few years, doing quite a bit of work to try and clarify what the non-commercial means for the purpose of the license. Our specific concern is that non-commercial could mean all different things to different people. If you're using a non-commercial, CC-licensed image on a personal blog, and you have ads on that blog, even if you don't make much money from it, non-commercial?
This is a problem that I've run into and why I don't use the non-commercial content either, because I don't know if, it's okay to use it on... certain applications, right? It's like there might be something that you're promoting that is not commercial, but if you're a commercial company, are you allowed to use it or are you not allowed to use it?
Right.
It puts you at risk. I'm not a fan of the non-commercial license, but I understand why people would want to publish their content under non-commercial license, but I don't agree with it, and I don't agree with it. And again, I guess I don't agree with copyright in general. So
right.
It
says here if you use it in a tweet. If you're a Twitter bio that promotes your business, is that non-commercial? And
I would assume that is commercial.
Yeah, right.
I mean,
legally, you're gonna get you have to be really careful because
I would think
they can take you to court and own you over anything.
I would assume pretty much almost every circumstance that somebody would want to use non-commercial licensed content is going to be technically is going to be commercial, for one reason or another. And so I wouldn't do it even on a non-commercial project like LibreCMC, for example. If I were running that, I wouldn't want to use non-commercial content, because if I link to thinkpenguin.com, for example, which is a commercial site, and I receive funds from that, and I'm not even a registered nonprofit, somebody could technically take me to court over it.
So they say, 2 years ago, we wrote about Creative Commons stepping in to file an amicus brief in a case that raised some specific issues concerning a non-commercial license. An educational nonprofit, Great Minds, sued FedEx over FedEx office shops photocopying some Great Minds works for educational entities, even though the works were licensed under CC's by NCSA 4.0 license. Great Minds argued that because FedEx made money from copying, it's commercial and thus violation of the license. Creative Commons stepped into that lawsuit and explicitly stated that Great Minds' interpretation was wrong. In the FedEx case, both the district court and the Second Circuit appeals rejected Great Minds' interpretation and tossed out the lawsuit, saying that the license in question did not limit FedEx from charging for copies.
Yeah, it does seem utterly ridiculous, particularly considering the fact that the person doing the copying is doing it for non-commercial purposes, clearly, and just simply happened to use a rented copier, essentially.
Great Minds
so
sucks.
How would that make the copier liable? Or, I'm sorry, the company that owns the copier liable? That just seems ridiculous. They're not the ones doing the copying. They're not the ones hitting the copy button.
Great Minds, I'm going to add my own thought here. Great Minds, not content to go on without letting people know what losers they are, also filed a nearly identical case against Office Depot in California, which was also dismissed. Despite Great Minds claiming that this case was different than the FedEx one, specifically it argued that Office Depot employees were actively soliciting schools to copy Great Minds' works. The court didn't buy it. That case has now been appealed to the Ninth Circuit, who, as we noted all too frequently, mucks up copyright cases. And Creative Commons is back again, asking the court if it can file an amicus brief again. This seems like the perfect situation for an amicus brief, given that the Creative Commons certainly should understand its licenses the best. The proposed brief is well worth a read. Creative Commons appreciates that valuable contributions to the development of open educational resources made by Great Minds, along with its use of a standard CC public license to enable broad reuse of the materials it produces. However, its interpretation of the Creative Commons license at issue in this lawsuit is incorrect. As the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit correctly determined in Great Minds' prior suit against another copy shop, FedEx Office, the license authorizes a bona fide non-commercial user to discharge her licensed rights by directing a third party, like Office Depot, to make copies at her instruction. Creative Commons welcomes and respectfully seeks a similar holding from this court. Under the Creative Commons non-commercial license at issue, a bona fide non-commercial user may... it's just repeating what was already read there. going into details, CC explains how Great Minds is completely misinterpreting its NC license term. It says the license fully authorizes the conduct that Great Minds contends on appeal is unlawful. The only licensee here is the school district. Under the terms of the license and prevailing principles of a law, a school district may permissibly use Office Depot as a means by which the school district exercises its own licensed rights. The license does not restrict the school district to only using its own employees to exercise those rights. It allows the school district to engage anyone, employees and non-employee contractors alike, to do so.
It does seem kind of odd, though, that the school is actually hiring out to another party to do the copying for them. Like, you would think that they would already have those types of facilities. I know when I was in school, they did.
Yeah, they had
copy
machines.
Would you pay a premium for an outside entity to do
some schools
copying?
Are smaller, you know, it depends on what kind of school it is. It might not be like a public school where it's getting their $4,000 or $5,000 copy machine paid for by taxpayers.
Yeah, that's true. I could definitely, but you know, even a small school, I mean, it's not like copiers are expensive,
or a printer, you know, like
even if you were unless you're like a couple, maybe if you were a couple room schoolhouse or something, but I suspect that's not the case here.
If you're looking for an all-in-one printer, think penguin.com.
Yeah. Great insert there. Think penguin.com sponsors the show. I don't know. It's a sad situation where people are basically taking advantage. And this is the only time I've seen this. I've seen people take advantage of the GPL license conditions where you can append your own conditions. And they basically made the code unusable unless you pay them a license to use GPL code. It seems absolutely insane, but I have to wonder if it's actually applicable. If you're not actually in this case I'm thinking of, you would be distributing the code because it's JavaScript probably. I don't know, but yeah, it's certainly people are basically taking advantage of free to basically build business models in ways that are deceitful, and I look down on that. Those are the types of situations where I go out of my way to make sure that I don't pay them.
Hopefully the Ninth Circuit Court, doesn't change the decision.
So when we get back, we're gonna go into cryptocurrency startup that creates a decentralized Pirate Bay alternative. So everything that we've ever wanted to see happen is finally happening, and we've also got a demo too. After these commercial. And we're back. So, cryptocurrency startup creates a decentralized Pirate Bay alternative. This story is from Torrent Freak. And I have to say, I had a chance to check this program out, and this is really awesome. It's awesome, not because it's like for pirating. It's not for pirating really. It's just the technology is just really cool. It's decentralized search engines. It's a decentralized search engine for finding torrents, torrent content with spam, basically a spam, what seems like it will be an effective spam filter. And this is one of the things that were always a problem with LimeWire, with people injecting basically spam, fake content that wasn't what people claimed out there. And there is some moderating of the Pirate Bay as an example. It's not something I use personally, but other search engines. And so this is hopefully going to solve basically these problems. And they've got a really cool way of doing that using cryptocurrency. So let me get into the story here. A new cryptocurrency startup that popped up recently aims to offer an indestructible alternative to torrent sites. Oh, and they even did it right. So turns out they're not doing this in a public way where you know who they are. It's basically being done by people who are doing it anonymously. So it's going to be much harder to attack the developers of the software than it was for something like LimeWire. Now, it doesn't mean it can't be attacked by them if they can figure out who is publishing. Hopefully they were smart enough, because they've at least claimed to be doing it anonymously. But we'll wait and see. The software itself isn't, there's no reason it should be censored. But some of the arguments used in the LimeWire was it LimeWire? I forget now one of them, but I believe they said just because there's content accessible via this method, it's magically has to be, it's illegal. Even though you can also find legal content via that method. But that's the problem with centralization. So here we go. Decentralization for torrent search. With Quality Magnet Coin, the platform's users all share the torrent database with help from the blockchain. Add in some incentives for quality contributors as well as spam control, and Hollywood may have a scary problem on its hands. Yeah, I mean, I'm not so concerned about Hollywood so much as creating a decentralized platform, essentially for distributing content. Because if Hollywood can take it down, the governments of the world can take it down. And I think copyright undermines democracy. So tools like this are really valuable. There's no shortage of blockchain-related file-sharing projects. We have covered quite a few in recent years, ideally those with an actual working product. While most offer novel solutions for marginal problems, a new project that recently crossed our path stood out. This definitely stands out. And this is something so new. It's not even like out yet. It's like alpha quality and was published last week.
You know, this is interesting. I wonder, a thought dawned on me that I wonder if, you know, the huge surge in anti-free speech, just basically freedom online from the major companies has to do with the fact that they know that uncensored everything is coming soon.
I don't know.
In other words, and I wonder,
they're trying to create a niche for themselves, essentially.
Right. And what's interesting is that they're going to be creating these kind of walled gardens, you know, these family friendly walled gardens. But we all know how that plays out. Walled gardens fail miserably.
They do.
You know, the whole AOL thing. You know, what else? I mean, what other walled gardens? Can you name a few other? Like, I know AOL. That's the one I can name right off the top of my head. And it failed because it was a miserable walled garden.
I mean, people want content that's outside of your walled garden. So it does tend to lead to failure. I think there have been some walled gardens that have been able to scale better than others. I think
Apple's App Store, I think, is maybe a successful one, but that's not even a great
walled garden. But I was actually thinking more like the Debian repository is a kind of a pretty decent scaled walled garden, because they allow for new contributors that are vetted. It actually does work pretty well. It's not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but it's considering it's a non-profit type of situation, it's outlasted pretty much every other commercial distribution that's ever been released. So I would say that's a success. Even if Ubuntu goes bye-bye, there's still the base of Ubuntu is still going to be out there. It's going to be Debian. So ideally those with an actual working product. While most offer novel solutions for marginal problems, a new project recently crossed our path stood out. The goal of Quality Magnet Coin, QMC for short, is to build a large torrent magnet index that's impossible to take offline, censor, or block. The core idea is fairly straightforward. The application uses the blockchain to create a decentralized database of torrent magnet links, which doesn't rely on hosting service or domain name, making it virtually impossible to take down. Now, if there's there's something called there's something called bootstrapping. And if there is a server out there that is needed to bootstrap, the software, it could still potentially be attacked in other ways. Hopefully this is totally decentralized and there's, you know, it, when you get the software, it comes with thousands of servers that are fairly reliable online, so that if one server goes down, it can just go to a different bootstrapping server, and eventually you'll be connected to all of the, you know, the whole network, basically. While other existing services and plans are focusing on a pay to seed, that is paying for uploading the actual data or the files to people who are downloading, we are focused on the creation of a decentralized and searchable database of files to download. Think of it as a decentralized Pirate Bay, the QMC team tells us. That's going to come to bite them in the ass if they ever get, in a legal situation. I would have, you know, and it's unfortunately kind of sad because, you know, it is a great comparison, but it's also from a marketing standpoint, but it's also a very terrible comparison from a legal standpoint. It will end up creating a synonym with piracy. And if you create a synonym with piracy, it's going to be a much easier to attack than something that is not made that, comparison. QMC could potentially fail because of this very thing that they're doing. It's once the software is out there, you know, it's probably gonna be hard to take down, but at the same time, if you go after the developers, you do need updates to software and such. And if there's nobody up, it would be ideal if the team that basically developed it initially was the same team that continues to develop it. Because at some point, you know, if they keep attacking the developers, you at some point lose any kind of ability to trust anybody. So which fork of the software is, you know, developed by people you can trust? In addition to keeping a record of all transactions on the blockchain, every user also stores the database of magnet files. This is constantly synced with the network to update it with new magnet links and to remove those that are frequently voted as bad, searching the QMT tool. QMC relies on its users to build the magnet database. Everyone is welcome to submit a magnet link to the database, but it comes with a catch. Submitting a link. Now, this is kind of cool. And I know there's been a lot of people attacking it for this. I think people don't totally understand the need and the value of this. Submitting a link costs a user one QMC. But in return, if the magnet is voted as good, they can get five QMC back after a month. This investment concept acts as a double-edged sword. The costs prevent spammers from taking over the system, while the returns encourage people to share. At least that's the theory. Yeah, and it seems like it's got a potential to work too, based on I think what we've seen elsewhere. QMC only just got started, but they have a working project available. Yeah, it works. I've tested it. I've demonstrated it in a video that we're gonna play at the end of the show.
So how do you get started if you only like they give you a little bit to start with, or
I still haven't quite figured out how to submit a torrent.
How would you get the initial QMC to even be able to do so?
Well, it's a QMC tool is what you would use to insert the torrent, and it's just really confusing.
But it just said you have to have a coin or a QMC token in order to submit.
I'm not sure.
So you would have to have at least one to start with.
So there is, I believe it's going to be like any other cryptocurrency, basically, and it's just tied into this one cryptocurrency. So that gets generated just like any other cryptocurrency. So there's going to be people who mine for it, and then you can potentially buy from it, or you can mine yourself. And there's staking, I think. And there's a pool. I mean, this cryptocurrency is so new. This system is so new that I'm not even 100% sure if the tool that I was using actually works to insert insert stuff. There is a box to basically insert a QMC address, but I'm not sure if that's a receiving address. I have no idea what that is. Like, I don't know what I'm supposed to put in there. And when I tried to put in a receiving address, thinking, well, maybe that's the address that I'm supposed to get coin back at after a month, I couldn't ever get it to take it to work. So ultimately, it's still up in the air. I would love to see a video demoing that. I personally wasn't able to figure it out. I didn't spend that much time on it. I did spend quite a bit of time building the software, that particular software. Now, the QMC search part of it to download and search torrents, that is, they've got a built copy of that, so that's easy to do. But actually inserting, building the software to insert torrents, that's still a little bit more complicated. And even if you didn't have to build the software yourself, it's still... even if it was just a straight binary download and you could double click and open and like start dealing with it, it's still unclear. And I'm not even sure you can do it right now, because I, based on what I was reading from the forums, it sounds like it's something that's you're going to be able to do it soon. So the software's out there, but you have no way of getting coins.
It's
going to
be really interesting once we start seeing the convergence of stuff like this, like MadeSafe and Library.
Yeah, and MadeSafe is another one. Library, both. I want to do a demo of Library at some point, and certainly MadeSafe. MadeSafe has been in the works for years. Unfortunately, it's still not out. But Library, you can actually go out there and check it out. Mm-hmm. Library is actually developed by Jeremy in our community over in Manchester actually develops that, so that's a really cool program, and it actually works too. So it's kind of cool, because there's a lot of stuff out there that, you know, it's conceptually it's cool, but it doesn't really work, or it doesn't really work well. There are also more than 25 masternodes at the time of writing, which I think there's over 100 now. Masternodes at the time of writing, which helped keep everything running smoothly. Considering it's like less than a week old, the software, from being announced and released. At the moment, 10% of the master, and it's still like alpha quality. At the moment, 10% of the masternodes holders have to vote a torrent as good before a payment is made. Oh, that's interesting. So this is something I missed the other day. At the moment, 10% of the masternodes have to vote a torrent as good. So I'm guessing the payment part of it doesn't actually work yet. So I'm wondering if that must have been a receiving address for QMC, as opposed to a, I don't even know what a sending address is, because obviously there's nowhere to send it. So right. I guess right now you don't have to pay the one QMC, but you will later on once it's, you know, up and running. When we tried the QMT application, which works, the program froze on a few occasions while searching. The T, well, that's interesting. QMT is the application to submit a torrent. The program froze on a few occasions while searching. I didn't experience that. The team is aware that there are maybe some issues.
I don't think
initially.
Searching would be the application to be submitting. So,
well, that QMC is the application that you run to do a search. If you're just a user and wanting to search for torrents, QMT does have search. You have to be running QMC, but then you run QMT, and then you can search with QMT.
Right.
But it's mainly for submitting your torrents. The team is aware that there may be some issues initially, but they plan to continue improving on it. The magnet search from the wallet itself seems to work smoothly. I need to search from the wallet itself. Yes, it does. QMC. Search results are presented in a basic list. This includes a download link to load magnets into any regular torrent client, plus a link to instant.io where they can be downloaded or streamed through a WebTorrent. Yeah, that's pretty cool. It works too. As for the magnet database, there are just over 5,000 magnet links at the moment, which is very limited. Yeah, there definitely wasn't much content out there, and unfortunately was nothing I felt comfortable downloading. However, the QMC team is currently exploring partnerships with torrent sites to expand it more swiftly. Yeah, I would love to publish to this system as soon as we have the opportunity to show. That also brings up the inevitable legal issues. A lot of the magnet links point to copyrighted content. Yeah, it did seem like that, which is illegal to download or share. This may be a concern to rights holders, but the QMC team stresses that the software and network itself is content neutral. Yeah, it definitely is content neutral, outside of what people will vote on. We have no intention of copyright infringement, just like Tron doesn't, for that matter, even though they want to pay users for seeding torrents. They say, pointing to the BitTorrent Tron partnership. Oh. Oh, no. Okay, I understand that. I thought they were saying they were related to them. They're not. We simply would like information to be free and available to everyone. Totally agree. Information is always silenced based on political views or other means of pressure, and we want to change that with what our users choose to post is up to them. On the non-annuity side, the wallet has built-in support, so this is really cool too, for access over the Tor network, which users can enable in the configuration file.
That is super interesting.
So that doesn't mean that when you're streaming content, it's going over Tor. It just means that, you know, searching for and downloading content is the torrent file itself is over Tor. So they can't target users for using the application, et cetera, et cetera. The QMC team itself hasn't revealed any of its members to the public either. Also very cool. But notes that this may change in the future. A full white paper speccing out the project objectives and details is in the works as well. The QMC wallet and QMT search tool are available on Windows. The QMT is the
I don't know that you need to read the whole roadmap here. I think you could probably just...
Yeah, so it is available. It is available for GNU Linux, guys, if you want to go try it out, Windows and Mac. It does have a roadmap here. Yeah, it definitely, there's a Bitcoin Talk forums, and there's a website. Let me just give out the website. So the website is, can you read that?
QMcoin.gq, is that it?
Yeah, I think it's
web.qmcoin.gq. That's a very bizarre domain name.
It is. They literally just throw it up somewhere, clearly. But yeah, so that's the show. Now I'm going to go and I pre-recorded a demo of this so people can actually see this working in action. It is really cool. Was there anything else you wanted to say, Johnson?
Check out Liberty Minded. I'm constantly updating and adding new stuff.
Oh, there's a bunch of great shirts. You want to tell them what you added?
Sure. I mean, I've got a bunch of, copyright shirts, anti-copyright stuff. Some stuff. It's Liberty Minded is obviously pro freedom gear, so I've got some stuff against law enforcement and taxation. And...
Yeah, you definitely. All right, so today we're gonna be looking at Quality Magnet Coin, which is a really cool new program that decentralizes search for torrents. So. It's sort of like a torrent search site replacement. So basically, you can go to web.qmcoin.gq
Q, and you can download the software. It is in probably alpha stages right now, maybe beta. It actually does seem to work. So what we're going to do is come over here and open it. I've already downloaded it. And it basically adds a combination of cryptocurrency and a torrent search engine. So what we have here is basically the crypto part. If you submit a torrent, it costs 1 QMC, I believe it is, and if people upvote it, you will get back 5 QMC, and this is to prevent spam, so it works pretty well. And here is send and receive, so it's just like a regular cryptocurrency. And then there's some there's a privacy section. It's really cool. It's built off of Zerocoin, which, for those who are not familiar, Zerocoin is a protocol that basically adds true anonymity to, it's mathematically provable, to cryptocurrencies. And there's only a handful of cryptocurrencies out there that have this. Monero uses something else. I'm not sure that Monero is quite to the same spec or standard as Zerocoin, cryptocurrencies based off of Zerocoin protocol. But Zerocoin is not itself a cryptocurrency. So Zcash, Zen, those would be examples of cryptocurrencies that implement the Zerocoin privacy or anonymity protocol. So then there's transactions here, and then you have master nodes, and as you can see, it's still kind of in beta, but this is basically what it looks like. And you can search for a torrent because it's totally decentralized. There's nothing to shut down. One of the issues that has arisen with torrent search engines is because there's a lot of pirated content out there that you can find in your typical torrent search engine, that some entities that dislike freedom have gone and gotten the torrent search engine shut down via different malicious means. So what you would do is you would search. Now, there's not many torrents in here, but you can go ahead and search for, you know, a torrent, and if there's a torrent, you know, with the term that you search for, it will come up. There's so few torrents in here that you probably won't come up with much of anything when you go to search for anything. But this has just been released last week, basically, so it's not really too surprising. Yeah, so this is what it looks like. So this is QMC Core. Now, I have had a chance to try and play with, I shouldn't have exited out, play with this, inserting, rather a program to insert torrents into the search. And that's what Quality Magnet Coin, Quality Magnet Tool is. I did have some trouble setting it up, and I don't know if that's because it's not working yet or what the story is, but RPC settings, this is what you should basically have in it. You can search here also for you know, a torrent. And yep, so that works. And then here is where you would add a torrent. I haven't successfully added a torrent, unfortunately. But you got the full name, you got the magnet, URI, QMC payment address. And I'm still not sure how this is supposed to work, but I'm not sure if this is a receiving address or a sending address, or I don't even know if that makes sense. But anyway, I guess it would be a receiving address. But anyway, so somehow you were supposed to have to send one coin. But yeah, so this is really, really cool.